You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The last time Colin Quinn was here, he explained how he could cover on his Broadway hit show called Long Story Short, the history of the entire world from caveman to the present in just 75 minutes. Well, I guess that was pretty exhausting because he's narrowed his focus just a bit for his latest production called Colin Quinn Unconstitutional. In it, he relates how on May 25th, 1787, 55 delegates in wigs and tights sat down to create a country from scratch, and he ponders whether what we have now is what the Founding Fathers had intended. In the process, the Saturday Night Live and In Living Color veteran manages to make you laugh and think at the same time. The show is at the Barrow Street Theater now through June 4th, and I'm very pleased it has brought Colin Quinn to our show again.
Thank you, Leonard. Good to be back.
I'm not sure most people would find a lot of humor in the U.S. Constitution, Colin. What provoked you to consider it as a subject of a one-man show?
Well, what really provoked me was I was so annoyed by my whole life people bring up the Constitution and say how brilliant it is, but I just never understood what was so brilliant about it. Like, everyone's like, the Founding Fathers are brilliant, the Constitution is brilliant. So I started to say, I'm going to try to do a show about it because that's the only way I'd force myself to be interested enough to research it.
So first, of course, you read the Constitution, and then you—
That was four pages, by the way. It's only four pages.
Did you like it? Do you think it was okay?
No, when I first read it, I was like, yeah, just as boring as I remember it. But then I started really looking at it, like what those four pages had, and I was like, wow, it's pretty deep. You know what I mean? Especially for those times, but it's deep.
And then you had to do a lot of research, I imagine.
Oh, I started reading these books that were written, you know, in like the 1920s when nobody could— they didn't have to entertain you. That was the only entertainment. So they wrote, you know, very specific language. So it was like, you know, there's no TV, so you had to read. And it was like, it was brutal. I mean, the details they go through, the digressions into how many, you know, what each guy owned land-wise, what each person did, you know. And there's two philosophies of, you know what I mean? There's a left and right, like everything else, a left and right philosophy from the 1920s about what the Founding Fathers' motivations were, you know.
And were you convinced? Did you find one side more convincing than the other?
Well, yeah, I mean, one side, with the side that was sort of about how they weren't just trying to rip people off and have the bigger business interests, I ended up agreeing with. But that was written later as a response to the other one. So in fairness to the other one, when you write the second thing, you know.
Well, some people have suggested that we need to convene a new constitutional convention because the old one really is not working all that well in the modern world.
Right.
What do you think?
I agree 100%. I can't believe we haven't had like 10 already in this history of the country. That we haven't had. We should have one every 15, 20 years.
Well, we do have amendments. Aren't they intended to do the same thing?
Yeah, but it's not. It's a core thing. You know what I mean? Like you said, between all the partisanship and just all the gridlock that goes on, it does need to be. You know, there has to be another way of doing this. It's a little bit updated a bit. You know?
Well, it was a reflection of the time. Slavery was in place, for example, and there's an awful lot that deals with slavery or makes concessions to the southern
states. That's right. Yeah.
Why is it that you feel that a lot of drinking played a role in the first constitutional convention?
And by the way, if we ever wanted to make these constitutional conventions work again, we would have all the drinking. Like, they have these lists of all the manifests of how much they drank, and it was like hundreds of bottles of port every week and, you know, hundreds of things of beer. And, you know what I mean? Like, they just were drinking the entire time, you know? And but I feel like if they brought that to Congress— see, the problem is Congress always wants to leave because then they want to go drinking. But they brought the drinking into the room itself, so nobody left.
So perhaps the government would work better today if everybody was drinking during a session of Congress?
Yeah, if they made that the bar so you're not trying to run out. You're there. They give great— if they brought in great food and sandwiches and beer in there or liquor, it would be a different situation.
Have you come to this conclusion because you used to be a bartender?
No, but that apparently shades all my work, because even this show, people are like, hey, it reminds me of that thing. You keep going back to this bar metaphor. I'm like, I know, but that's just the way you think as a bartender, probably.
But you also say that your Irish American background gives you special insight into the way that things went down.
Really? I don't know. Maybe somebody else said that, but I'll agree with it.
Do presidents— one of the things you talk about is the way presidents look.
Yes.
And you feel that the presidents who were not as good looking actually had to work harder?
Well, I feel like they were more effective people because ugly people know how the world really works, whereas good-looking people, when they enter a room, everybody's more or less like trying to figure out what they can do to accommodate them. And ugly people walk in a room and the reaction is, what? What do you want? What do you have for me? You know, so that's why they know how to work better.
Although it's usually more difficult for someone who isn't good-looking to get elected.
Right.
We've had a few less than handsome presidents over the years.
They were all ugly until John F. Kennedy, and then, you know, Lyndon Johnson took care of him.
FDR wasn't bad looking.
Was that?
FDR wasn't bad looking. Calvin Coolidge.
FDR wasn't good looking.
Well, we're not going to get into that debate.
You're right.
You also talk about political correctness. When did that sneak into the culture?
I think that started around 1990, maybe 19. I mean, probably in the late 80s. I don't really remember, but I mean, I know it's progressively gotten more absurd over the years.
So is it always a bad thing? Isn't political correctness also based on the idea that you don't do things that hurt other people?
Well, do things that hurt other people, right? But I'm talking about linguistically, we've gotten to a very absurd point where if you point out someone's identity, their ethnicity, in a conversation, you know, for example, if I was telling you a true story and I'm like, well, this Mexican guy, people go, whoa, why does he have to be Mexican in your true story? You know, they're like,
because he was a Mexican.
Right. And then it becomes this weird thing where people are trying not. There's just this overcompensation level of sensitivity. And then it becomes that thing of, you know, certain people are just like, that's troublesome language. That's inflammatory rhetoric. And then, you know, who's deciding that? You know, where does that decision get made? It becomes very.
Well, that doesn't seem to have helped President Obama, who's constantly under attack.
Well, I mean, he's under attack from one side, but I mean, as far as he's under attack this week, that's for sure. But I mean, in the general sense of the way the press, you know, he's the first president the press actually wants to like him. They want him to like them. And what I also talk about in the show is that nobody's ever made a joke about President Obama in the 5 years he's been in office. The only person that's made jokes about the president is him. It's gotten so bad, he has to make jokes about himself to tell everybody, hey, it's okay to make jokes about me. Every year at the White House correspondence, I do it, and there's no fallout.
So when you say these kinds of things, does your sense of humor get you in trouble?
I don't think so, but, you know, who knows? I mean, you never know if you're in trouble or not these days, you know?
Well, there's some comedians say things, and they wind up losing. They wind up losing their jobs. They wind up losing the one. A comedian who's been on our show a number of times made some terrible joke about the Japanese and wound up losing a very profitable commercials job he had.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I don't really have that many jobs to lose. I mean, in many ways, I guess it's like I have to create my own shows. So it's not really it's not for me to lose a job when I don't have them.
Well, how have you evolved as a comedian from stand-up to MTV, then Saturday Night Live?
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, MTV was kind of like a whole different ballgame. We were stand-up comics, the guys doing it, but it wasn't about stand-up. It was this wild-like show. It was like a party show. So we thought we were still being like stand-ups. So we were like part of this New York stand-up scene. So we'd go on the road, and people were like, woo! And we're like, hey, guys, let me just throw some humor at you. What about this? And people were like, hey, just sign my T-shirt. Yeah. And you're like, yeah. No, but guys, listen. And we were like trying to be these comedians, but everybody's like, no, we're just here for the party. Don't you get it?
But you were doing Weekend Updates.
That was after that, right, yeah.
You actually have to be up on the news to be able to do that. Did you write your own material?
No. I mean, I wrote some of my own, but I had people sending in, you know, in that kind of a situation, you're just like, hey, whatever you got, you know what I mean? But, and it's so funny because when you had all these different people sending jokes, there were always like two, like some young kid would send you jokes. It's just like Twitter today. Twitter today, people respond to me on Twitter, and they're funnier. They think of funnier things than I'll ever say. It's so weird. And they're not even comedians, some of them.
Well, your bio states that you're currently the king of Twitter. You have how many people following you? A million plus?
No, I wish. I have like 250.
That's all? 250 people?
250,000.
Oh. Well, Twitter actually fosters a lot of virtual fights, doesn't it?
Yes, there's been a lot of death threats against me on Twitter, but
really,
yeah, but
why? What have you done to lead people to want to kill you?
I speak like very positive, like I'm like, hey guys, let's make today the greatest day ever. Then people are like, please, the greatest day ever is if you get, you know, stabbed to death, and I'm like, hey, come on, fans, don't be like that. You know, I try to like give them.
You don't want to sign them up for writing material
by being so positive that they just naturally people want to kill you. You know.
My guest is Colin Quinn, who has written and performs Colin Quinn Unconstitutional. It's running now through June 4th at the Barrow Street Theater at 27 Barrow Street. For ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Your first show was directed by your friend Jerry Seinfeld.
Jerry. Big Jer.
But you didn't get him for this one?
No, we didn't get Jer for this one. He's busy, apparently.
Rebecca Trent?
Rebecca A. Trent, yes.
Is she was she good for you? Does she understand how to make you look funny?
Yes. She was. She owned this club, Creek and Cave, that I actually... It was a club and a restaurant, a comedy club in Long Island City, where I worked the whole show out for this year.
Now, why do you do this as a theater piece rather than as a stand-up routine?
Because nobody in a stand-up club sitting there taking their orders with mozzarella sticks and jello shot, they're not going to sit through an hour of thematic. You know, stand-up, they used to, first of all, thematic. If you go one, people are like, hey, change the subject. It's been 4 minutes. Second of all, you know, it's not peppered with enough, like, you know, the humor that works at stand-up clubs.
Well, you could start off with saying, hey, where are you from? That's what. Philadelphia. Hey, you know what happened in Philadelphia?
Yeah. Where are you from? Kansas. That wasn't one of the original 13. I don't want to talk to you, idiot.
The New York Times predicted real problems for Saturday Night Live next season because so many people, including Bill Hader, are leaving. But hasn't that always been the way it is with Saturday Night Live?
They should have real problems. The point is exactly that. You have to shake it up. If everyone says, well, what do you want to do? Keep the other people there and play it safe? Yeah, that's why you go into banking, not why you go into comedy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, that brilliance of that show is like sometimes it stinks, but it's just rolling the dice. You can watch them take gambles.
I've been amazed that it's lasted so long with so many lame routines.
Yes. Well, Sarah Silverman.
And every once in a while, they just hit a home run. And maybe that's what keeps you coming back.
Yeah. Well, Sarah Silverman said it years ago to me. I remember I said, what do you think of the show the other night? And she goes, it's like going to Vegas. She goes, if the two sketches in a row fail, you're still like, you know what? The next one could be good. And she goes, and that's the brilliance of the show. And she's right.
Now, Jerry Seinfeld talked about television. He said if you tell a joke there, that joke is done. And you did a lot of TV.
Sure.
And you've done a lot of TV. Has that been your experience? Do you like the idea that every audience that comes in to see this show is new to it?
Yes. I love it. I mean, of course. You know, I mean, it's every time you do it. But I think it's definitely nowadays there's just so much exposure. You have to pick up the pace, you know.
And is this a scripted play?
Sure.
So you don't do any ad-libbing?
Well, I mean, once in a while I'll throw something in because there's nobody else that I have to worry about. You know, if it's a play, you have other people, you screw up the whole show if you mess with them. But when you're by yourself, people like me, Alan Cumming, I mean, we...
No. You're comparing yourself to Alan Cumming, who's coming on the show later to talk about playing all the roles in Macbeth.
Exactly. I'm playing all the roles in the Founding Fathers, in the Constitutional Convention.
So what was Mr. White like? Was Kent worthy of a street named after him in Williamsburg?
Well, yeah, that's right. And, in Williamsburg, there's a lot of...
Barry? Oh,
yes.
In fact, you know, Mel Brooks tells this joke about his brother trying to remember all the names of the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence. And he said, well, just remember all the names of the streets around us. You know, Hooper, Rodney Keep. So his brother did pretty well until he wrote Broadway.
Yeah, what about, but Berry was the interesting one, like Eldridge Berry. There's a lot of interesting, Governor Morris, like these guys they're not that famous, but they were like the real, Governor Morris wrote the whole Constitution, by the way. You know, he wrote it out. I mean, he's the one that phrased everything, like he was this amazing writer.
So you've done the history of the world, now you've done the Constitutional Convention. Do you have something else in mind for the future?
I'd like to do something about, like, I don't know, like either inventions or like quantum, something with quantum, even though I really don't know anything about quantum.
You could do quantum physics?
Not quantum physics, but something with quantum, just everything quantum, you know?
Yeah, well, because you like to say quantum.
Yes.
Yeah, because, but you realize that you could become a Bohr. That's a quantum physics joke. I'm sorry. Niels Bohr.
I think once you do a show about the Constitution, you're already... Oh, Niels Bohr. I thought you'd be a little Bohr. I said, I already am one from the Constitution. Don't worry.
Colin Quinn Unconstitutional is running now through June 4th at the Barrow Street Theater. That's at 27 Barrow Street. And if you want information about tickets, you can check us out at on our show page at WNYC.org. Does this one run about the same length as the last one, 75 minutes?
No, it's a little shorter than that, probably 65.
Okay, well, it's worth every minute.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks, Len.